Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode of Silent Giants is brought to you by Ally. Ally, powered by Verizon Locations, are developed by Verizon, the world's leading technology company. In collaboration with Ally, a membership-only community workspace for creators, each location is a community curated and powered by the emerging technologies and thought leadership of Verizon. With Ally, Verizon is bridging the gap between startup and corporation by helping the community workspace build next-level ecosystems with entrepreneurs. And now, on to my interview with Tony Peralta.
There's a game that people play. There's this kind of like weird kind of like friend nepotism thing where people hook up their friends, right? So I hit a wall with that because I didn't know who, you know, there isn't necessarily an agency out there. There might be just one person. And I was just like, you know what? I'm just going to continue doing it.
Yeah, check it out. I'm your host, Corey Cambridge. Everybody tuning in, you invited. No matter what mood you in, get excited. Everybody love the music. Let me tell you how they do it. Whether writer or an agent, let me tell you how they made it. You are now talking to a silent giant. Wanna walk in their shoes, silent giants. Wanna study their moves, silent giants. Wanna know what they do, silent giants. Silent giants, y'all.
God bless everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Silent Giants, a podcast that highlights the superstars behind the scenes of popular culture. I'm your host, Corey Cambridge. Our special guest this episode is legendary New York City artist, fashion designer, and entrepreneur, Tony Peralta. A native of Washington Heights, Tony is the living definition of what it is to be a New Yorker. A Dominican-American born to immigrant parents, Mr. Peralta began his professional artistic career as a graphic designer. His art, inspired by his Dominican heritage, New York City, and hip-hop culture, has been revered by art lovers and critics all over the world. Tony is the founder of Tala Peralta, a clothing line with a flagship location in his native Washington Heights neighborhood where he was raised. In this interview, I got to chat with Tony in his Washington Heights apartment about growing up in New York City, how his career in art began, we talk Tala Peralta, he shares entrepreneurship insights, and so much more. Without further ado, let me introduce you to the artist, graphic designer, fashion designer, entrepreneur, my friend, the silent giant, Tony Peralta. Tony, what's going on, bro?
I'm good. Chilling, man.
Dude.
On this rainy Wednesday?
It's a rainy Wednesday
in
New York in October.
I know. It's a terrible, terrible weather today. It's kind of cold and rainy. This is not my favorite weather.
Oh, I would say no, it's not.
Yeah, because
not for me either.
Because it's cold and rainy.
Well, it's not like a January rain.
It's not like a January rain, but it's
a chill rain.
It's like you could get sick.
You can get sick from this, mm-hmm. Absolutely. Especially with like the weather. What was like last week? It was 90 degrees.
Yeah.
So it was like 90 degrees last week.
Mm-hmm.
It never hit like above 73 again.
Yeah.
And then now we have like a cold, rainy day in October.
Yep.
But yeah. It's the vibe though. I feel like this is it's just one of those days you could like stay in the house and play some jazz.
This is definitely
smoke a little something, play a little Sade.
This is what I call first day of school weather.
Absolutely.
Yeah, like this is what I remember first day of school to be. Like this is what motivates you. Well, you're not motivated to get up to go to school, but you don't feel bad being in school because it's raining and it's ugly. And there's nothing to do.
Yes, this is that great day. The adult version of that is going to work.
Like yeah.
Going to the office.
Exactly.
It's a great going to the office.
Yeah, thing. Because you're
staying
not
staying late in the office.
Yep, yep,
yes.
Exactly.
Yes, like mm-hmm. Not going to happy hour.
Yeah.
Putting in the extra work.
Yep, yep.
Dude, it's so good being here at your place. Your place is so like quintessential New York. It's like your vibe.
I've been told that plenty of times.
It feels like a movie.
All right, I've been told that. And then there's a train, the one train passes by.
Yeah, you hear the train going by, you walk in, you have like the courtyard,
mm-hmm.
It's just total New York.
Do you get to see the cat?
No, I didn't get to see the cat.
Okay, because there's a cat. There's like the he's the mascot of the building. He's just like a street cat, but he lives in the building.
I mean, the cat is a the mascot for New York City.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. If I had to say, what animal do you see the most of? Well, cat and rats.
Cat and rats, yeah. And there's always, you know, and there's, you know, I've grown up, there's always been like cats, like they, because they're always like on in the back of the building.
Yeah.
So even in my old building growing up, there used to be a couple of like alley cats that we'll call them.
Well, we have alley cats, but then we also have like the bodega cats.
And the bodega cats, of course.
And they serve a vital function.
Yes, they do.
Yes, they are extremely important.
Yeah. I mean, they get rid of the rats.
Indeed.
That's why they have it in the bodega.
Well, I mean, I figured that.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, you have to put food around, so it makes total sense.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, Tony, it's a pleasure to have you here on the show. We met, man, we were just talking before Mike's, you know, got the mic rolling, that we met right when Silent Giants, the week before I debuted it.
Yeah.
You know, so it was like 2 years ago, man.
Yeah, time flies.
When I went back and thought about, like, when did I meet Tony? It was like literally 2 years ago.
Yeah.
Shout out to Lanice Logan.
Yeah, shout out to
Lanice. That's how we met, because we were on her panel.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Her love panel. When I think about you, Tony, I think about the quintessential New Yorker. Like, your story is the story of what a New Yorker is to me. And from moving here, I'm from Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've kind of learned about New York culture, you know, over the course of being here.
Yeah.
But your story and your narrative just fits the mold of what I think a true New Yorker is. I think you, I've had the pleasure of interviewing DJ Clark Kent.
Mm-hmm.
He's someone as well who I feel like, and Babito Garcia.
Totally. Definitely the quintessential New York. I mean, those two guys are definitely the quintessential New Yorkers. And they also represent a different generation than I do.
Yeah.
Because they're an inspiration. You know what? They both are, but especially Babito. Especially Babito, because he's somebody that has made, well, they both have. They both have made a living in being themselves. Right? And it's pretty incredible. I mean, I've met Babito before and speaking to him, and it's like, how, especially back then, like maybe 10, 15 years ago, it's like, I didn't understand how it was possible for this guy to just make a living off of literally being himself.
Literally. Right?
And I'm in that position now.
Yeah.
But it's mind-blowing to me. It's crazy.
Also, too, he had the ability to make content, like, and go viral.
Yeah.
Before the internet. You know what I mean? Because of the way that radio show and the way they were able to, people were burning tapes. He kind of went viral and had, like, he was involved in content. And now we're living in an era where I feel like content, we're living in the premium content era.
But the thing about Babito, after seeing his documentary, the last one he did, he was the first of so many things that I was like, huh, word. Yes. Like the sneaker boutique in New York City, the whole basketball thing. He's so incredible, man. Like, that guy is a national treasure. It's, you know, and then it's, I can't, like, you know, props to Babito, man.
Yeah, absolutely. What would you say is the definition of a, I have my definition, but what is your definition of a quintessential New Yorker?
Quintessential New Yorker, I don't know. I think we're like a last of a dying breed. I mean, in regards to like that generation, and I think I represent a last, like, I'm 45, so I grew up in the 80s and I was a teenager in the 90s. So growing up, so being in elementary school and in junior high school in the 80s, I grew up with still this old sensibility that ties in a whole bunch of different generations, right? Like, I remember a time where the TV at midnight, there was no programming. Right. And, you know, and seeing how like tough New York City was. So being a New Yorker, you have to be tough and then being first generation immigrant, like you come here and you have to kind of fall in line. You know what? Being a New Yorker is learning how to pay your dues.
I totally agree. I was out in L.A. and every time you go to L.A., it just treats you so nice when you land. It's so
I love L.A. so much.
I love L.A. It's so nice. The weather's always great. People are always smiling. And I was talking to this guy on a camping trip when I was out there, my boy C. Todd. And he goes, man, if you move to L.A. in the first 2 years, everyone wants to be your friend. Everyone wants to work with you. It's like the fastest 2 years of your entire life.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, dude, my New York experience is the exact opposite. I've been here for 9 years, and I'm just starting to. I felt like around year seven, year eight, I just started to kind of find myself and find my lane and, you know, kind of earn some stripes here in the city.
Yeah, because the thing is, like, especially if you're dealing with New Yorkers, like, if you're dealing with people that have been here for a long time, or you're dealing with real New Yorkers, you're dealing with people that already have their real friends, like their set of friends. So it's like, it's not easy bringing in a whole new person because it's like, yo, you don't know my mother.
Right.
You ain't grow up with me.
Right.
Right. Or if you're, or, you know, if you're New York, or if you're somebody who's been living for here for 10, 15 years, like, you went through that whole process. You know, it's like there's a process to go that you go through here in New York City to be let in. You know, and you is literally paying your dues. That's why, like, you know, a lot of people come off as like bitter because with a younger generation, because these a lot of people want to cut corners, you know, with everything. And it's like, and you know, we didn't grow up that way. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's just, yo, you just, it's paying your dues in every way. It's just like, even like being in the block and being made fun of. And like, right. Like there's just this thing that you go through as being a New Yorker that you go through this like training as from a kid being made fun of, that you have a thick skin, you know, people snapping on you, you know, and then you start learning how to like have a sense of fashion and learning how to talk back to people. You know, kind of learning how to trust people, like learning how to like pay attention to your surroundings.
Absolutely.
You know what I'm saying? So like if a loud noise happens, you're like, all right, what's going on here? You know what I'm saying? When you walk in somewhere, you're looking around or like, all right, where I'm at. That's some New York shit.
You know what I find fascinating too, Tony, is that, you know, when I'm, most of the people that I get to interview here are based here in the city or are from the city. And everyone, New York is always like your girlfriend.
Yeah.
Right? It's always like, it's a city you have a relationship with.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the...
For sure.
I think that's like the, to me, the best part about New York. It's not just a city. It's something that you date.
Yeah.
It's something that you experience. Mm-hmm. You have highs and you have lows together.
Yeah, I literally have a love and hate relationship with the city.
Yeah. It's the girlfriend that she's kind of a headache. But the sex is great.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the sex is great and it keeps you in it. You're like, I'm going to stick in this.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, you there's moments where you like hate the city, and then there's like, you know, then summertime comes and you're like, oh my God, you know, like then you like, you love it. And then by the end of the summertime, then in August comes, you're like, all right, I'm over this shit. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's how it is, you know? But yeah, New York is a very interesting place, and you know, and it's changing a lot as well. You know what I'm saying? Like the things that I loved about New York City is kind of disappearing, you know?
Tell me about your parents. Who were they and what were their professions and how did they shape your life?
Yeah, so I grew up in a single parent household, but I knew, you know, my father was around after a certain. He moved back to the Dominican Republic when I was 12, but I would see him every weekend because my father owned the bodega in the Bronx. You know, I grew up on welfare. So even though we grew up on welfare, my mom was an entrepreneur. You know, she was a hustler in her own right. Like she, for instance, like, in the summertime, my mom would go, we used to live close to the park And she would make patelitos, or what people call empanadas, but Dominicans call it patelitos. Okay. So she would make patelitos and like lemonade and go to the park, because these people will be playing like they will be playing bingo, and she'll go sell those, you know, and come back and she'll make like $100. In the 90s, they used to, so Washington Heights was known for like, we used to sell drugs. Like this was kind of like a distribution hub for cocaine, right? We used to sell weight, people would come here to buy like kilos or whatever, and from all over. And my mom would make lunches for the drug dealers that would be hanging out. Cause basically it's like the dudes in my block in 187 where I grew up at, the schedule for people who were being on the block is 12 to 12. So you cannot leave because customers are going to come, right? And they can't leave the block. So my mom used to make lunch for them. My mom would also buy like clothing by the pound and take it to the American Republic and sell it there. You know, my mom at one point accumulated a certain amount of money that she opened up a food truck in the corner of my block.
Wow.
When I was 16, right? It was one of the first food trucks uptown, you know, I remember. My dad was an entrepreneur, like, you know, he owned the bodega. And so an interesting story, I didn't know this about my father, and I just learned this about 2 years ago. When he first came here, he worked in a factory. They both worked in a factory, but then my mom got sick and then she couldn't work. That's why we was on welfare. But my dad worked in a factory and he was like, didn't feel like he was making enough money. His cousin taught him how to drive. He borrowed his cousin's car the next day and drove a taxi. And when he saw he made $100, he basically started like driving a cab, and he would stay outside until he would make $100 a day. And each day that he drove a cab, the $100 would go towards something. So if it would be towards sending money to DR he would budget it differently. And he made so much money that somebody sold him a bodega.
Wow.
Somebody sold him a space, and he already had enough money to fill it up to stock it up. So that was his story in regards to that. So my parents were like, I didn't see it back then, but as I started to come in, accept being an entrepreneur because I'm an artist, and once like things start to take off with me as far as my online business and opening up a shop, I noticed that I come from a line of entrepreneurs, right? And risk takers. And I looked back at my family and looked back at my mom and my dad, and these people were the ultimate risk takers, you know, coming here to this country. Like, they both didn't speak English. They both still didn't speak English to this day, you know what I'm saying? But they managed to make, you know, to raise, you know, my mother raised four kids and my father has a bunch of other kids. But he, you know, he lives in the American Republic, and, you know, he has, he raises cattle and stuff like that.
What were your early aspirations professionally as a kid?
I've always daydreamed of being an artist. When I was a kid, that's all I knew how to do was draw.
Where did that origin come from?
I don't know, man. Like, you know, my earliest memory of drawing is kindergarten, getting in trouble first day of school for trying to draw the teacher and attracting too much attention to me, right? And then I was a daydreamer. You know, I would daydream in class and like daydream. Like, I thought it was special for some reason. I honestly, you know, the movie. Truman Show.
Yeah,
when that movie came out, it bugged me out because I used to think my life was that when I was 8-9 years old. I used to think that my life was a TV show, and when I went to sleep, it was over. It was like, it would basically like the snow would come out.
Yeah,
and then when I wake up, the TV show would start again.
It's interesting that you always feel like you were special. I've always said, I never actually interviewed anyone that had that mindset about themselves early on. And I definitely feel like as a child, I always felt like I was special or different.
Yeah.
But I felt like it was instilled in me from my grandfather. He would always kind of let me know, like, bro, I think you're cut differently. You know? Who was there anyone in your life that kind
of that's the
made
thing.
You feel special?
No, it was just me. It was just me and my imagination. Cause I was an introvert, you know. I was just kind of like to, you know, I grew up, I have three other siblings. When I was, you know, I have a younger sister, so she wasn't around until probably when I was 10 or 11 years old. But prior to that, I was just, you know, watching cartoons and just into my own little world, man. You know, drawing, I would always draw in class. And I was just daydreaming about being famous for some reason, right? And then as a teenager, I felt like I was put here for, I felt like there was a purpose for me here. But I had low self-esteem. And when I was a teenager, I was depressed. But I still had, but there was this thing where I felt, I had a purpose in life. I didn't know what it was, right? So because I felt I had a purpose in life, I didn't sell drugs, right? I didn't, because trust me, I could have done it, right? But I felt that this was a deterrent for me not to be in the street life was. If I would, the first day that I would sell drugs, I would go to jail because that's not what I'm supposed to be doing in life. So that was always a deterrent. Mm. I would get punished. It would be a punishment. So I remember having conversations with like the girls from my block, and it's like the drug dealers in my neighborhood, like all had like Porsches and fly cars and like the fly girls. And I would be like, yeah, I'm getting that. I'll get that later. I'm not an envious person. I wasn't envious of the drug dealers. I knew all of them. They were all cool people. You know what I'm saying? And if anything, I think that they probably saw something in me because I was just like kind of an artsy kid, you know, because they could have easily put me on as well. But yeah, I was just like this weirdo outcast kind of person.
How did you know at what point in your life that you could take your art and make it into a career? Like, I think there's some folks who just, they like art, but they're like, you know what? This is something that'll be a passion of mine that I can do as a hobby. At what point did you realize, okay, I'm going to step out and make this into a career?
No, that wasn't really until later on, because junior high school, so the kind of student that I was in school, I wasn't really good academically because as I learned later on, I'm a visual learner. So I wasn't doing well in school. And unfortunately, I really wanted to go to this art high school called Art and Design. That it's a famous school. Like people like Pharoah Monch went there, and like Mobb Deep went there, almost every graffiti artist in New York City went there. And I didn't have the grades to go there, so I went to my zone school, George Washington, which it's up here. And I went into a deep depression when I went into that school because I didn't want to go there. And reading the 3 years in, I read the autobiography of Malcolm X, and then that really kind of like brought me out of the darkness that I was in. And I took my GED and I wanted to be a history major. And I went to Long Island University with being a history major. And the first semester, it was a really hard history class, but I was really into like Caribbean history and history of people of color. Because at that time I was like, you know, conscious, you know, as they say, woke now, I was like, you know, listening to X-Clan and Brand Nubians and all that, you know what I'm saying? After taking that first history class and figuring out that I have to also learn world history, I was like, nah, I don't want to do this. And somebody told me about this like communications major. And when I walked into their lab, I saw was like TV production and graphic design and all that. I was like, oh no, I'm doing this. Because it's everything that had to do with stimulating my visual.
Yeah.
And there was also film production. And I switched my major and I wanted to be a movie director. Because I love Spike Lee.
I could totally see.
Yeah.
See you in the world of film.
Mm-hmm. I switched it because I wanted to be a film director. And I was a huge fan of Spike Lee and Quentin Tarantino and all that. And so when I graduated from college, that was my goal. I couldn't find a production assistant job. So I went with Plan B, which is being a graphic designer. So that's when, I saw that I could do let's say art for a living, you know?
Yeah. What was the first step in your career of breaking into graphic design?
I was out of work for almost a year. I used to work this terrible job. I worked the graveyard shift. So that was just a terrible schedule, very depressing working graveyard shift. And a friend of mine started working for this PR marketing, this boutique PR marketing company that did PR and marketing for urban brands, right? So this is in 1999. This is at the height of like FUBU and Academics and 555 Soul and all these great brands. And my friend helped me get a job there. And this opened up. I was like, this was like the start of everything for me, like going to Vegas for the magic convention and being part of like the urban fashion that's when everything kind of like, I was like, yo, like meeting other creatives of color, you know what I'm saying? Like there's people that I'm friends with, you know, I met Daytuan through that, you
know. Wow.
Yeah, like because Daytuan worked at this company called hook.com, like, you know, it was pretty incredible. So I started working for that company and I became like design director and like designed their site and their whole identity, did a whole new identity for them. And that's how I got my foot in the door.
What did you learn from being someone who was, you know, outside of the industry to now being in the industry? What was the biggest transition adjustment for you?
It, man, because it's like, yo, I'm this kid from Washington. Me and my best friend, the guy at that time, Leo, like, we were just these two dudes from Washington Heights, right? Like, and here we were, like, I mean, what I learned is that people party on Tuesdays and Wednesdays, and there's, like, parties that people get free drinks. And, like, you know, and, like, everybody lives in Brooklyn, and everybody lives in Fort Greene, and, like, everybody knows each other, and everybody went to, like, kind of like the same schools and shit like that. Like, you know, like the networking, like a lot of the networking happened where these people lived, right?
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
At that time, like everybody lived in Fort Greene, you know, and, or everybody went to Howard or everybody went to Clark, you know what I'm saying? And I didn't, you know, I didn't go to none of those schools, you know what I'm saying? So, I mean, Leo, my friend Leo went to Clark. So that was kind of like a way how he kind of got put on to the company we worked for, because that was called August Bishop.
That's a great point you bring up, because I think for most folks who aren't from New York City, it's kind of hard to get a grasp on, like, New York is so big and there's so many different pockets.
Mm-hmm.
Like your neighborhood is your zone.
Yeah.
So like you're really far from being uptown and mm-hmm. being from the Heights.
Yeah.
It's a completely different world. You might as well live in DC.
Yeah, you might as well.
as far as like connecting with people.
And you see, like, for instance, like you when you hear Diddy's story, like Diddy went to Howard and like he basically built his networking there. And everybody that works, a lot of people that work for Diddy are from his like Howard days, you know? So, you know, networking is very important, because if it wasn't for me starting to work at that company and meeting all those people that I met throughout those years, when I started doing the Peralta project, I would get like in a magazine in the Source or another and like little like press hits because of the people that I met at that time, you know?
Yeah.
Because I was just doing this on my own. So you know, networking, and it's extremely important. You know, the people that you know is very, very important. You know, that's why I get frustrated a lot with people in my community a lot, because so many folks want to be a big fish in this small pond, and it's not like that. Like, that's never been my goal, you know, and I owe a lot to knowing people outside of my community. You know what I'm saying? Like, I spent 5 years going to Long Island University in Brooklyn. You know what I'm saying? Like, I know, you know, even before and even after going to Long Island to school in LIU, when I was doing the clothing, when I first started doing the Peralta project, I mean, I did.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Afropunk second year, like, not there was like a street festival, like after Afropunk, there was like a street vending thing. I did that 2 years straight, you know. So like going from uptown all the way to Brooklyn to do vending, you know. I've done Artisan Fleas in the very, very beginning in Williams, when it was just in one space in Williamsburg. Now Artisan Fleas is all throughout the city.
Yeah.
Right. So I've always thought outside of the box and outside of my community, because these things weren't happening here anyway. So it's like, I need to go hustle outside of here, you know? And it's kind of like thinking a way of like how drug dealers, you know, like when you think about Jay-Z, Hov always talks about like going outside of, like going to Virginia and going to DC and places like that to go peddle his shit, right? And that's kind of like the same way that I kind of thought about it the same way.
Tell me about Peralta Project and that step into entrepreneurship. Mm-hmm. Like, what drove that?
I mean, what drove the Peralta Project was my love for like streetwear. And, you know, I think like hip hop forces you into entrepreneurship. I've tried being a rapper for like a week or two when I was 17. And I was terrible. I breakdanced when I was younger. A lot of people don't know this about me, but me and my friends would, because my brother was a DJ and my older friends had DJ equipment. Two of my friends had DJ equipment set up in their rooms. We would pass the time DJing. So I used to DJ. Obviously doing art, and like, and there's, you know, there's this element of fashion and like having ideas. And in the 90s, you know, there was these like bootleg t-shirts and stuff like that. And like me and my friend had this idea of like doing a t-shirt, and that was kind of like my first t-shirt that I did was 17, when I was 17 years old. I went to this Zulu Nation reunion party, and this guy was selling t-shirts, and I asked him where he got them made, and he told me. And we went all the way to the Bronx to this woman, and she made, you know, I had a job, and so did my friend, and we scrapped up our money and we made our first t-shirts. So that was my first taste of like doing tees. And then, you know, after working with August Bishop, the company I worked for, and seeing like being in urban fashion, all like my favorite graphic designers all had like their own kind of like t-shirt brand, like their own independent t-shirt brand. So I started my own thing too. You know, I was working as a designer somewhere, and I just kind of like did it for the hell of it, like just doing it on the side. You know, I would go on the weekends to different stores to try to get my stuff into stores. So it was just really kind of like a hobby and doing something for myself. You know, I started, and then I learned how to screen print, and I started to do art, and it was just, I started to do art and screen printing just to kind of like balance my life, not be in front of a computer all the time. So on the weekends, I would go to SVA or go to this studio downtown and just create art pieces and balance between having a full-time career, doing the Peralta project on the side with the t-shirts and stuff like that, and also doing the artwork.
One thing I love about your art is that I can look at one of your pieces and it says something. One of my best friends' name is Steve Boone.
Mm-hmm.
He's a very talented guitar player.
Mm-hmm.
To me, he's just the best guitar. I love guitar players. Like, it's like my spirit talent that I wish I had. And there's so many guitar players that you hear and they're playing. And then there's guitar players you hear and they're saying something.
Mm.
They might as well be writing a lyric with their chords. But I find it the same way with any great artist, that your art has to have a voice.
Yeah.
And it has to say something. Where did you discover that voice and how you were going to translate your art to other people?
Well, you know, again, being hip hop played a part in that, because being a fan of bands, you know, groups like De La, but also groups like Public Enemy and X-Clan and more of those conscious artists, I've always been into music that had a message. For instance, like, I don't like reading fiction. I like nonfiction. So when I first started to do the work that I did, I spoke on like police brutality and like things like that, like just kind of like, since I couldn't rap, I put it in the art, you know, and it was very kind of like, so like a social activist through my artwork. And so for the first couple of years, that's what I was doing. And then, you know, sitting here in this apartment, which is pretty small, the work started to get a little bit too heavy for me. And I was like, I need to change it. And and one of the things that I noticed is that going to galleries or going to exhibits, I never saw work that represented me and my people or Dominicans or anything like that. So I switched up the style and started to do things that represented my culture as a Dominican and as a Dominican American and as a Latino.
Tell me the steps of you opening your store. Like, how did that come about?
Yeah, so we just made 2 years this week. Like,
congratulations, Don.
Thank you. Yeah, this week. It was like this week. This week. Yeah, man. So in true New Yorker fashion, I was sick of New York and like looking to leave. And I think I was just like writing the year out, and I went to check out this guy that I know. He opened up a shop, and I saw that next door it was empty, and I inquired about it. And you know, I was always familiar with that space, and I always thought it was cool because it had like this like weird kind of loft. And I don't know. I looked into it and saw that the rent was affordable, and went the extra step. Got my, you know, they checked my credit and I got approved, and it was very scary for me. Like, because one, that wasn't the goal. I never thought, I've always like, imagine wanting to have my own shop. Like, I've always thought, man, if I had my own shop, like, it would be like a coffee shop slash like gallery or whatever. But I never saw it here because like the rent is pretty high up here. And I don't know, I lucked out, but that wasn't the goal. Like the way that what I saw happening was I was going to move to LA, probably live somewhere that had a garage and run the Peralta project out of the garage. Right. And maybe try to open up a shop in LA. Yeah, so when I got approved, then I was like super nervous about it, and I spoke to my dad and I spoke to some of my friends and family, and I took the plunge, you know, and it's been a blessing. You know, I literally walk, you know, 10 minutes. It's a 10-minute walk from here. It's just crazy to me, you know, like you go to Williamsburg and like you see people open up little coffee shops and they're like, they live down the block, you know?
Yeah.
And I never saw that reality for me. You know, and to be able to live that reality now is pretty incredible. And it's the first of its kind. Like, there's never been an artist up here that has their own shop in Washington Heights and Inwood.
What was the breakthrough moment for you when you realized I'm making it?
So I had quit my job in 2009, right? And, you know, things were kind of happening little by little. And then I had landed a freelance gig and I was going 3 times a week, right? It was a friend of mine. She was great. I was like, look, like I can only come in here like 2 or 3 times a week. And I'm only going to come from time like to 10 to five. And she was like, cool, you know, and that freed up a lot of space for me to work on my artwork and focus on the Peralta project. And after those 3 years was up, you know, and it was like not by choice. Like they told me, like, you know, like Tony, like we can't, you know, we're going to hire somebody full time and you don't want to work full time. So this is pretty much like it's over. This free. I was like, all right, cool. And I was like, and I told myself, I'm not going to update my resume. I didn't want to go through that headache of like coming up with the right writing of how to explain the million things that I do. So I was like, I'm not doing that. And I just, at that moment, I was like, I'm not doing this. And just focus on like the Peralta project. And at that time, like things, you know, I think things started just to pick up a lot more online. There was a show that was called Washington Heights that came out that definitely helped because I was already making that kind of up like hyper local clothing. I did a couple of pop-up shops up here, and then like once I posted the my Frida con Rolo, so 2015 was when with the artwork that shit just like really took off as far as just like kind of going viral in a way and people knowing who I am more and stuff like that. So that was definitely a moment. But so there was like two moments. So it was probably like 2013 and then like 2015. Like those, there, you know, I think those were the two dates. But I wasn't going back to work. And then I think 2015 is like I'm not even taking on work. Like I don't do freelance for anybody. You know what I'm saying? There was a moment where I said, I'm not doing no work for anybody. I'm just focusing on myself.
For people who are creative and being creative and having a passion and a talent for creativity is one thing. Stepping into entrepreneurship is a completely different realm.
Yeah.
You could be non-creative and be a great entrepreneur.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
From being the creative who became an entrepreneur, what was the biggest hurdle for you to overcome or to learn?
Man, everything was a learning. Like, things started to get scary because it was like you're making a certain amount of money and it's like I'm not doing things right. You know what I'm saying? So I you know, from tax, you know, I would always pay my taxes, but I'm just like taking forever to do it because I didn't have a bookkeeper or anything like that. So there was this thing called, so I started to seek out help, you know what I'm saying? This thing called like Think Small, Think Big, Think Small. Like it's like a not-for-profit for like small businesses.
Okay.
So I started seeking out the help just to get information because, you know, you're hitting another level being an entrepreneur. You know, you're making a certain amount of money. And with me, it's like, I'm not trying to get in trouble with the government.
Of course.
So I'm trying to avoid that at all costs. So I want to know all the information and all the things that I need to know and the things that I need to get in order to not get in trouble with the government. You know what I'm saying? So that was like the biggest hurdle is just like that learning curve because I'm not a business person. I'm not a math person. I don't like that stuff, you know. I don't like spreadsheets. I don't do those things, you know. Like, I got myself a good, you know. I have an accountant, and I have a really good bookkeeper, and that stuff is life saving. You know, it's a lifesaver. And now I have a financial advisor who's fantastic. So those things alleviate a lot for me, who is not a numbers person, you know. And I'm still learning. You know, I'm definitely still learning, especially now with like dealing with, you know, these corporate partnerships and stuff like that.
For creatives who are looking to work with, you know, corporate entities,
mm-hmm.
What is something that they should be prepared for before going in to that endeavor?
So, you know, what was it? Like 4 years ago, I feel like I hit a ceiling and a plateau, and I was like, I want to have corporate partnerships. I didn't know where to go, right? As a person of color, you know, there's New York City is a place where people just fuck with people that they know, right? There's like this, like, there's these guards. I don't know, like, there's a game that people play. There's this kind of like weird kind of like friend nepotism thing where people hook up their friends, right? So I hit a wall with that because I didn't know who, you know, there isn't necessarily an agency out there. There might be just one person. And I was just like, you know what? I'm just going to continue doing me. And that's what I did, right? Just put my head down and continue with what I know how to do. And what happened was I get random emails from these because I build my following organically. And you know what I'm saying? Like, it's literally going straight to the people. So my journey is different. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm not, and I like the way that it's going for me now, because when you hit me up, you have to deal with me in my terms. Because I don't need you anymore. You know what I'm saying? I appreciate anybody who sends me an email, any kind of corporate company who might want to work with me. I appreciate it. But if I'm not feeling your idea or whatever, I'm not doing it. I don't care. It's not about money. You know, it's not about money for me. You know, I love doing different things, though. So that's where I'm at in life. You know, and so my advice is like, I mean, it all depends what your motive is. You know what I'm saying? Like, I got to a point now where it's just like, I just want to live a comfortable lifestyle. And I also want to like represent properly. And, you know, and I have a great staff. And with me, it's like, if I just want to be able to make enough money and make more money so that I could pay them more, you know what I'm saying? So yeah, you know, it's like, it's weird that, you know, again, it's like, I like the position that I'm in because it's like people come, you know, these partnerships have come to me because they email me and they come to me to have these conversations. And sometimes I say no, and sometimes I say, yeah, I like to be in that position because it's like, I don't need y'all because you ain't fuck with me before. Like literally, like, we're in Hispanic Heritage Month, right? I've been hit up by like 8 different agencies, and I said no. Because I was like, y'all scrambling to do some sort of weird program, little programming in your offices for Hispanic Heritage Month, right? But you ain't hitting me up at the end of the year. I mean, throughout the year. Mm-hmm. You're not bringing me any opportunities. You want me to come and talk to your fucking white staff about me being Latino? Get the fuck out of here.
Which does them good.
It doesn't do me any good. Right. And right. It's like, what, you want to give me a fee of $500 or $1,000? Like, that doesn't do anything for me.
Right.
You know, like, that's not enough money for me.
You know, Tony, before we get out of here, you know, I end every episode of Silent Giants with this question. What have you sacrificed in your career, in your life, to achieve what you've achieved?
Well, I mean, I'm 45 years old and I'm not married and I don't have any kids. So that could be, you know, I live a very lonely life. So that could be the sacrifice. You know what I'm saying? I have, you know, most of my peers have families. I don't, you know what I'm saying? Which is something that I'm getting older now is something that I struggle with, where it's like, well, is that ever going to come? You know what I'm saying? And I have to, you know, it's something that I constantly have to come, you know, deal with and come to grips. I know that, you know, to some people, you know, I'm super young. To some people, I'm super old. I don't know. You know what I'm saying? All I know is that I am getting older. You know what I'm saying? And I don't know. And it's one of those things that I think about a lot. You know what I'm saying? That is the biggest sacrifice, because it's what has allowed me to be able to be where I'm at now. You know what I'm saying? There's a lot of decisions that I've made. Most of my decisions are all selfish, because I have, you know, I have a low overhead. You know what I'm saying? I don't have to think about putting a kid through college or babysitting or whatever. Like, my expenses are this apartment and like my shop and like, you know, the light bill and like internet. That's it. Like, you know, and whatever stuff I might buy myself once in a while. Other than that, that's it. That's my expenses. You know, I mean, you know, I have a staff, pay my staff, but that has been like the biggest sacrifice. And it hasn't been on purpose. It's just been, it is what it is, you know. And yeah, so that's pretty much been the sacrifice.
Tony Peralta, man, it's such an honor to have you on the podcast.
Oh, thank you. Man, thanks for having me.
You know, when I think about legend, when I think about New York City, when I think about a creative, I think about you, my friend.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
It's such an honor to have you on the podcast, bro.
Thank you.
Love you, man.
All right.
Thank you all so much for tuning in to another episode of Silent Giants, and to our special guest, Tony Peralta. This episode was mixed by Joshua Coleman. Are you a fan of Silent Giants? If so, leave us a 5-star rating and a nice review in the Apple app, and I'd be forever grateful. Lastly, before we get out of here, be sure to check out my other show, OPP, Other People's Podcast, highlights America's top podcasters and the dope shows that they created. You can find that on Apple, Spotify, and wherever else you listen to podcasts. Well, I'm your host, Corey Cambridge. God bless y'all. Till next time.